again. We are strangers as the fog goes rolling in. And you're over.
Named Joe. He wears a red bandana, plays a blues piano.
A honky-tonk down in Mexico.
He wears a purple sash and a black mustache.
A honky-tonk down in Mexico.
Well, the first time that I saw him, he was sitting on a piano stool. I said, and said, just be cool. He wears a red bandana.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Makes you such a threat. We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Chasha.
Chante washte na pechu zapielo. Ambetu washtelo le unkipiki he washtelo. Greetings and good day and welcome, my relatives, and with a good heart, I shake your hand. It's good for all of us to be here. In addition to relativity, this is First Forces Radio. I'm Teal Kazen Ghost Horse, and this is an all-native hosted, all-native produced First Forces Radio. And Liz Hill is a producer of First Forces Radio. And you can hear us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Buzzsprouts, Spotify, as well as First Voices IndigenousRadio.org for archiving, downloading, and listening. Our first guest, Joe Pitawanakot, is an Ojibwe from Wigwemkong and married with one daughter. And Joe is a founder and director of Creator's Garden, an Indigenous outdoor and now fully online education-based business. Creators Gardens is focused on plant identification beyond sustainable harvesting and teaching every one of their linguistic, historical, cultural, edible, ecological, and medicinal significance through experiences. Joe's programming is easily adaptable to make appropriate and successfully delivered to a variety of organizations, including 100 First Nations communities, 20 universities and 18 colleges, and dozens of various institutions throughout Canada and the United States and beyond. Joe has learned from hundreds of traditional knowledge holders and uniquely blends and reinforces it with an array of Western sciences. And I'd like to speak with Joe Pitawanakat. And now part one of my talk with Joe Pitawanakat. I'd like to welcome you, Joe, and it's a great honor to have you here, and thank you for being here on First Voices Radio.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me.
I read your story out of Canada. What happens to Joe Pitawanakat in his everyday life when he's out there in the forest, on the land, with the land, talking with the land, and the plants are standing out and looking at you?
Yeah. So usually when I'm like out in the bush, out in the forest I'm always with my daughter. Now we have a dog. So I'm always out with my daughter and my dog and trying to keep up with the both of them. Yeah. Just constantly just being surrounded by all of that knowledge is every day that I get home, it's always like super overwhelming. Like I'm real tired, mentally drained every time I get home. Wow. From those days that we spent outside.
I know you mentioned there's a certain responsibility that you have. It's an obligation rather than a right to a plant. In the Western mind, I think they think about, I have a right to everything. But I think it's different among Native people that we are obligated as responsible. So that same responsibility goes with your daughter. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah. It's been super fun since we had her around. She's 7. She's going to be 8 soon. And so now, you know, she can clock a solid 25 kilometers a day, no problem in the bush. And that's exactly what is normal, or what we made sure was normal for her, is our responsibility to the plants. And so she's growing up always knowing how necessary the plant medicines are. Like one example, she has, ever since she was first born, her first bath, they have been in medicine. Because we never had soap before. What we would do is we would make a nice strong tea with a medicine plant that's good for our skin and to help clean. And so that was just our life. And so when we were raising our daughter, for her, that was just normal to have a bath that was like this dark tea color. And in kindergarten, we sent her to school, and then she'd come back home and she's like, did you know, like nobody else, I asked everyone, everyone just pours water in their bath, like it's clear. And she thought it was so crazy. And so for her, like using medicine has always been like a normal thing. She gets a cut, she knows what to do. She has baths in her tea, and she's just constantly drinking all of the different teas that we have. Oh, what did you make this week? And then drinking it, telling us if she likes it or not. You know, it's just normal. And so for her, the other thing that's normal is our responsibility to those plants. And so when we're outside, I really caught her this year because of the amount of just miles we were able to clock in the bush. She was always grabbing seeds. She had pockets full of seeds, and she was taking plants and putting them in new areas, and just always in that mindset of responsibility. Like, these plants are my friends. They help me, so I'm going to help them. And just watching that in action this year was like so fun.
I'm hearing that children have a tactile relationship with the plants. And so you speaking your language of Anishinaabe, the relationship with that, is there a way that you describe the touch? And of course we can say the uses of it, but that's what we're supposed to be passing on, isn't it? That tactile relationship responsibility, as you have. And your daughter, you said you walked miles with her, right? How far are we away as Native people from that?
We are, I think, yeah, you know, maybe quite a ways away, because, you know, what we once called life is now intense therapy. Like when you take somebody who is sick, somebody who is developing diseases and accelerated aging and all of these things that we're dealing with, and you expose them to aspects of our culture like medicine or like nutrition and starting to look at traditional diets and things like that, when you start to provide that as an option for that individual, what once we called everyday life is now turning into being an intense therapy. And so, yeah, we are pretty disconnected from that. And I think that the more opportunities we do that we get to be able to, just like my daughter has, just be able to do it. And it's just kind of like that's her life, is just doing it. It's not talking about it. It's not imagining it or dreaming about it. She wakes up on, or she's going to bed on Friday night. Where are we going to go tomorrow? And what are we going to do? Because she wants to go to a good spot. She wants to be able to see all of her friends and interact with them, help them. Even though this year, you know what? We didn't even harvest medicine. I harvested like 2 bags of 3 different kinds of plant, like nothing. We're used to harvesting like 220 different species every year. And this year, nothing. All we did was explore new areas and help, mainly because that's what my daughter wanted to do. And so we just helped. I have lots of leftovers. I have lots that we have harvested from previous years. And so this year, yeah, it was just about the plants. Even though they weren't even helping us, we're helping them. Just like when you, just like with some people, you know how good it makes you feel when you could give something to somebody, not expecting anything in return. You just wanted to help them. So you gave them a gift that helps them. And that sort of feeling without really wanting or needing anything in return, is, it's a really good thing to provide to another human being. Is something that we could do for hundreds of species of plants as well.
You know, Joe, I'm thinking about those peoples who don't, or haven't really explored or the chance to learn and allow the plants to teach as they have you and with you and your grandma. But, you know, I think I read something where it's haunting not to know the name of a certain plant. Tell us about that.
Yeah. There's a couple of, so I'm in the middle of creating a resource right now for our YouTube channel. Just, I'm just recording for every single plant that I can, their names and breaking down exactly what that name means, what it is describing, and just releasing these, going to be releasing these just steady over the next, and maybe years. There's some plants that I just actually have not been able to ever hear their names. And some of them are super common. Like one of the most common and haunting ones, literally haunting, I think about it every day, is sweet gale or Miracle gale. It's a medicine. We use those seeds sometimes in cooking, like for flavor. You could put them in like a pepper grinder. It's really, really good. But as a medicine, they are used to help stuff our pillow, and they prevent night terrors. And so really, really important medicine. Really, really, really common, like around any slow moving rivers. Like it's everywhere. It's super common. It's a birch. It's in the birch family. And I've never heard its name being spoken once. And the idea of never being able to recover that name, maybe it will be gone forever. I don't even know, because in the name of a plant, it describes so much. It portrays, it projects the identity of that being so well. And then to miss that is terrifying. So it's my goal and maybe responsibility to do everything that I can to recover that. So that's super crazy, super fun.
You said 220 different plants actually. And then when you think about how Westerners use this way of trying to combine everything to make one, one size fits all type of medicine. Is that possible in medicines you're working with? I know you can combine here and there, but as you say, each plant has their names, has their specificity as far as portraying and protecting, as you say. But in far as my knowledge is concerned, each plant has a song. Has it gone this far where you realize that this song is actually the word you're portraying it as?
When you start to dig in and when you really want these answers, it's kind of scary to think about what may have been gone or what may be missing. But then also, you know, the opportunity or responsibility we have to get what we can, like even just to your first question, just about mixing medicines and things like that. Like when you go to make a medicine, take like women's medicine. My grandma was a midwife, so this is just like a supernatural place for me to go. But women's medicine, there is so many different plants and trees out there that can be used and are used like directly, specifically for so many different issues that women go through. And you could talk about each one of those individually. But when you go to make women's medicine, you combine all of those and you make women's medicine. You make that kwemshkeke. It was very hard for my grandma to look at one plant and say, that's women's medicine. Because women's medicine is not just one thing, it's everything all together. So you do what you can to make that medicine, and that's what it will be. So you take women's medicine, do the same thing for heart medicine. There's like, you know, 30 different species of plants that all work specifically with different parts of your cardiovascular system. And, you know, you think of the importance of that. The cardiovascular disease is the number one killer in indigenous communities in the entire United States, and I think every developed country. When you go to make that heart medicine, use it all together. And then you could take even a step back further from that and you look at all the heart medicines and liver medicines and lung and kidneys and bones and everything, all of the medicines that we have that help with these specific parts of our body, and you mix them all together. And we did do that. That was something, that was a medicine that every family would have been making. In my community, every family did make it up until about 60, 70 years ago, till that knowledge was gone. We were able to kind of pull that out of my grandma 6 years ago. We made our first batch of that medicine. And the year that we've been making it every year since. And the best year that we had to making that medicine, we had 119 different species of plants that was inside of like 160 quart or like 45 gallon pot that we cooked for like 40 days and extracted all of the medicine from that. And it was such a crazy process, but to be able to have the medicinal potential of every single plant within our georegion, all in one lick. That's the way that we used to make medicine. That's what every family used to have. But yeah, just the degree of separation is so great that we were actually the first people in my community or in my family to make it in 45 years, and the first people in our community to make it in over 20 years. And so we're doing what we can to teach as many communities how to be able to bring this important part of life back. That's a really funny and neat idea to think about.
I'm thinking about this one too, Joe, is I know the Anishinaabe culture reaches far and wide and cross-culturally transmorphing with other tribes, other native people. You find similar uses of it. Have you stepped outside of the Anishinaabe to discover other tribes using the same with a different word, but the same spiritual inflection to that plant?
Yeah. You know what? Exactly. So this is a beautiful question. I come across this idea the most when it comes to the use of the plant, it's generally pretty well the same across continents from the far north down into You know, even some of these plants grow in Central America. And so visiting with Mayan Zapatista communities, it was still the same thing. But the interesting things, though, really come about when you're looking at the names of the plants in the languages. Like there's one... one of my favorites is we call it Mushkoawis, or that's wild bee balm or wild bergamot, Monarda fistulosa. And this plant just grows everywhere. And in the Anishinaabe language, it's describing elk. Mushko is an elk, and Mushkoawis is that's elk medicine. That suffix at the end of the word indicates that there's a special connection between elk and this plant. And you could take advantage of that connection too. It's called Mijmakajigai. When you burn that medicine, and elk can smell that in the winter when all that plant is gone, all their favorite medicine is gone, but you're burning it. And so they're able to smell it. It overrides an instinct that they have, and they're reckless in their pursuit of that plant, that they will walk into your smell as well. And so to enhance the efficacy of your hunting, you'll be more successful, maybe even more ethical, because you're getting closer to that animal. And if you're looking at Sioux, Lakota, you look in any other language you could ever imagine throughout the entire United States that lives in the distribution range of this plant, everyone calls it elk medicine. It translates to in Lakota, in Sioux, or like whatever Dakota, whatever languages you're thinking of, it is always elk medicine, or this plant is connected with elk. That's what we have just been calling this plant for I don't know how long. And so it's really neat to see the taxonomy, indigenous taxonomy of plants, the naming of plants is really consistent despite the differences in our languages. The idea projected with it is still very similar.
You know, somebody named Jonathan Lowe said something about which your research was about is it that the language is encoded in our languages. But I do know it's something like quantum physics in our language. When out of that, if we are speaking the encoded quantum physics of that plant's name, that's part of the medicine. And I want to go to that because, you know, the next kind of doomsday thing coming up is that our languages are going to disappear at the end of this century, all indigenous languages, maybe up to 90%. Well, how do you feel about that when Western science comes forward and says this? Because, Joe, if I could take it to this place before I say anything, is that there's poverty. You know, like there was among the native peoples, there was the Western world was seeing poverty porn, so to speak. Now I'm looking at, well, there's plant poverty, and there's all these things that animals are having poverty now because of our inaccessibility to land. Land is disappearing. Medicines may be disappearing. Languages may be disappearing. So what you're doing, I'm thinking, is that by keeping these languages intact, your language of Anishinaabe with the plants intact, that it's an example to other Native nations, especially the young people like you, keeping this intact, that we're not going anywhere because we're the roots.
Yeah, you know what? So the problem, I guess, is that would be like a prophecy. That would be a prediction of the future. And in my understanding, prophecies are warnings. It's not that this will happen. It's a warning. And if that prophecy comes true, you failed to stop it. And so then we're coming back and looking at responsibility again, and our responsibility to listen to what these scientific projections and prophecies are, and heed to that warning and say, I'm going to do what I can to make sure that this doesn't happen, that this prophecy doesn't come true, because I want to be successful. And so this is why what we do, just getting people out, engaging in this type of knowledge and recapturing it and making it normal again. So that things like this don't happen, so that this prophecy doesn't come true, so that it fails and we succeed.
And we'll be right back with part two of our very compelling interview with Joe Pitawanakat after this from the Community of Beings. And the song is Burning Times, taking you into part two of Joe's interview here on First Voices Radio. I'm Teo Kasing, Ghost Horse.
Thank you. hands still burn her, stripping her down with mining and the poisons of the war. Said to us, the earth is a healer, a teacher, a mother, a weaver of a web of light that keeps us all alive. She gives us the vision to see through the chaos. She gives us the courage. It is our will to survive.
And you're listening to First Voices Radio. My name is Teokasing Ghost Horse here, and part one you just heard was Joe Pitawanakat, who is an Ojibwe from the Anishinaabe Nation. So Wigwim Kong is the founder and director of Creator's Garden, an indigenous outdoor and now fully online education-based business. And we now will go back to part two of Joe Pitawanakat. It's very interesting, and stay tuned. I'm thinking about the Anthropocene, that people are projecting that, you know, we think too much about the human first. But when I refer to the relationship the Native peoples have with the earth, and I'm speaking about a particular concept, in this case, finding out that a lot of Native nations do not have the concept or the word for domination. And it has to be a relationship with the medicines, with the plants, with the earth. Because if we start dominating, then we're just putting our foot on everything and saying that we own, we're more intelligent than the plant. Yet when I grow a garden, it's not that I'm growing it. It's the garden is growing me. And so Anthropocene seems to be another thought process. So what I'm thinking is like, wow, we have so much intelligence out there. And when you're in that, and when you're teaching your little girl, that's the intelligence. That's our responsibility. I'm thinking that way. So in that way, I'm thinking what you're doing. I see all the medicines back there that you have, you know, you're storing. That's what it's going to come to, because I'm walking here, Joe, and I'm not seeing any birds. I'm not seeing any deer. And I'm only seeing humans and their dogs and their pets. And I'm like, what happened to all of this? When I was a boy, it was full. It all seems to be missing. Is that true among the woods where you are in Ontario?
Yeah. I mean, like just speaking from a plant-centric perspective, plants rely on really intricate connections to be and relationships to be able to thrive. And so our job is, our job is just to listen to grandma and do what she says. And mm-hmm. and what grandma has is thousands of years of protocol, of rules to follow that are designed in a way to make sure that you're helping those plants, that you're playing into you're there to help them. It's crazy when you're looking at plants, the systems that they rely on in the Great Lakes region. As what makes it different than other parts of the world is that the way that they distribute the seeds, the way that they distribute themselves, the way that they reproduce, every plant seems to have a flaw or a problem that can help ensure that that plant is living to its fullest potential. And so, to your question, just about, development and changes in the environment, plants rely on an incredibly specific and intricate connection between ants, bears, mice, owls and snakes. So in order for a plant to distribute the seeds, most main medicinal species rely on ants to grab the seeds. We always think birds grab them and poop them out somewhere and that's where it grows, but that's true in other parts of the world. But when it comes to the Great Lakes region, birds, mice, chipmunks, anything who eats these seeds destroys them, digests them and destroys them. And so they end up being the worst enemies. Instead, what our plants rely on is for the ants to collect all the seeds, and the ants prepare the seed to germinate. It's called myrmecocory. They eat a case. There's a case around every seed that prevents that seed from being able to germinate. It's called the eliasome, and that eliasome is nutritionally complete for ants. So they collect all the seeds seeds, eat that eleison, and now that seed is ready to germinate. But what the ants do is they store it inside of a giant cavern in their nest called a midden, and that's where it stays forever until a bear will come to eat the ants, eat the larvae. And what the bears do is they eat all of the seeds from all those medicinal plants that the ants have stored for years. The bear ends up eating those as well. So thankfully, a bear's digestive system is like 12 inches long, and the seeds go through the bear unharmed. They do not get destroyed or hurt. And so wherever the bear poops, that's where all of our medicine seeds are sitting. So the bear is what unearths all of that medicinal potential and puts it somewhere, deposits it somewhere. And mouse, mainly deer mice, they'll look at that big pile of poop and they'll say, hey, that's... look at all that food. That bear didn't even digest nothing. So what the mouse will do is it'll grab every one of those seeds and it'll bury them centimeter and a half deep throughout the forest floor and maintain this massive network of trails that is just running on a buffet table of all the seeds that it has stored. Now, what happens then is the mouse will eat all of those seeds and digest them and destroy them until... an owl will come and remove that mouse, until a rattlesnake will remove that mouse. Then all of those seeds will germinate and they will become our medicine. This is why bears are super important creature in protecting medicine. And owls and snakes, they have such important roles. Like one family of barred owls, probably one of the more common types of owls, can eat over 30,000 mice every year. That's a lot of mice that are being removed. That's a lot of medicine that helps to be planted. And so when you're looking at the barrenness of our green spaces, when you're looking on the land and you're not seeing any of the plants that should be there, like it's just sterile. There's nothing growing there because bears are not there pulling the seeds out, because there's no more raptors, there's no more owls and hawks that are removing the mice. And so a disruption into that system. And so that's what's causing this this issue of there just not being enough green access to green spaces, access to diverse areas with that have our medicines, is because it's all locked away because the system is broken. Whereas our culture, every part of our culture, every tradition that we have is helping with that process. Like when you go to make a, now I'm really good getting into it, but when you go to make a water drum, you get round stones that are used as leverage points to stretch the hide over the water drum, right? Those round stones, in a lot of communities that we go to, the only place that you get them is from anthills, because ants are obsessed with round things. They'll roll it home and there it'll stay. So you reach into the anthill and you pull out those round stones, and what you're doing, who you're acting like. A lot of communities will even make like a glove from a bear, and they'll reach into that nest to grab those round stones for the water drum. But what they pull out is all of those medicine seeds, and it's a garden of hundreds, all that medicine growing there. It's the most beautiful thing to see. Rattles that you make for kids, for babies when they first come out, you're using on grouse. Grouse will have that crop underneath their chin where they store all of their food. It's this big distendable organ, like a stomach, and it's see-through. So what we do with that crop is we let it dry while it's inflated, and it's translucent. You could see through it. And then we'll take the contents from the gizzard that has a mixture of stones, pulp from the food that it's eating, and seeds from all of the medicinal plants that it's eating. And so what's interesting about the bird, though, is that it because it's depositing these stones in its gizzard to basically be the teeth, it only gets hard stones that are above the hardness of 7. So like flint stones. And so that's what it deposits in its gizzard. So we take those flint stones and we put them in the rattle, put them in the crop that we dried out. And so when the babies shake that, they get that sound that they've been surrounded by for 9 months, you know, mommy's heartbeat, just all of that rhythm, that sound. And then they get to see the lights too, from those Flintstones hitting each other and sparking. And I remember we went to go make these with my daughter, and she, when she opened the crop of the gizzard, my daughter, who is 5 turning 6, she says, "Hey, look at all these seeds." And she was able to identify what those seeds were from, what plants they were from. "Oh, this bird must have ate these." Yeah, just being responsible for those plants and putting them back out there, making a rattle to comfort babies. Every cultural component, every cultural knowledge that we engage with is helping distribution or helping the diversity of the world that we're living in. And so when you're thinking of other systems being imposed, other systems coming in here and saying, "Well, this is the way we're going to live now," they are disrupting that system. And now we're here hundreds of years later saying, "What happened to the diversity?" and the culture is gone, and it's the culture that has been responsible for that diversity. So consult with us.
I definitely hear that, Joe. Thank you for that. You know, it reminds me of what they describe ecological diversity and biological diversity, but where's the cultural diversity? And I'm thinking that part of this is your daughter and your grandma. And I know you've learned a lot from your grandmother, but the other day I was watching a squirrel bury a seed, but their babies didn't know where that walnut was. I mean, when the mom buried, the babies weren't born then. So the baby came back and found that seed. So is the memory passed down through DNA? And I'm relating your grandma to your daughter. And obviously it's an action. So the memory of the squirrel's mother to maybe the squirrel's daughter, understanding exactly and having this honing device of DNA in our memories. Have you seen that enacted out in nature as well as among the human forms?
There's a lot of examples in nature of this really incredible portrayal of memory, you know, with elephants and stopping at graves of grandparents that they haven't had exposure to and knowing that that was there and having their whole mourning ceremony. There's lots of examples of that. And all of this anecdote, all of these examples is driving a fair scientific inquiry as to like how this happens, what's actually going on, because there's something that we don't understand. And so, yeah, you know, it's being studied right now. I'm super curious. It'd be nice to be able just to tap into that and just remember and recapture all those names that we have forgotten. But yeah, that is a really neat idea.
So I know that you said that you don't understand your language fluently yet. And I'm wondering if you're looking forward to that. And because I know this is the current trend, which to me, it always has been to recover our language. You finding it easier to recover your language by participating with that which is now separated from our language and more into a technical of explaining it in the English way rather than our original way? Let's say bear root. It can't be domesticated, right? It can't be planted anywhere else. It's on its own. And I think that's how our languages are. It can't be dissected in a sense that to be more subjected and objectified. So it became a noun. So what I'm reading, what you are doing out there, tending to the creator's garden, so to speak, that you are in the action. You're verbing everything.
Yeah. It's hard to separate that. Yeah. Learning the names of plants was definitely my vehicle to learning as much as I know about my language now, which I've been finding lately is fair. There was a language conference east or Toulouse, Little Travers or wherever the heck they are. They do so much language initiatives, and there was a whole weekend in the end of October where it was just all Anishinaabe speakers, and they were just telling stories. Like every workshop that I went to was just somebody sitting in front of their laptop on Zoom telling stories. Man, was that ever nice to hear. And so whatever fluency that I do have in my language to be able to understand the stories they were sharing was created from learning about the plants and what those names mean. And so, you know, the uses of English and the translations, this is necessary for me to understand what each of these syllables are doing. But, you know, it's really interesting about that conference. There are lots of the stories I was listening in on. At some, like one of them was describing going out to make jam with her mom, just talking about the day that they made jam. And then she stopped and she said, I don't remember that plant's name, but it's called highbush cranberry. So I'll just call it highbush cranberry. I'm sorry. And she apologizes for not knowing the name of the plant. So I just bust on and tell her, you know, what it was. And then she knew. And so it is like really neat to have that connection happen sort of live. And it was those interactions that are driving my to create this resource just on our YouTube channel. And going through each of these names, they're describing actions, verbs, really intricate details that are occurring, and objectify it would be diminishing what you're observing, maybe diminishing of the actual identity of that plant within that name. So it's just impossible. Like, I don't even understand how that can happen. Like, there's one plant that's called Gazebanushk. This is my favorite one to tell everybody because it's crazy. So Gazebanushk is describing a plant that ushk at the end of the word is just the plant portion. Just it's a plant being, and so the gazi is where that identity is. And so Gazebanushk, zebe is a river, and so this plant Gazebanushk, Equisetum hymali or scouring rush, it's generally beside a river or a water source, because the plant needs a lot of silica. I think it's like 13% silica, so it needs to be near moving water. Always by water. So it's always by zebe. And when I told my grandma, I made that connection that it's called Gzebnash because it's always by a river. She said, my mom said that the reason why we call it Gzebnash is because of the sound that it makes. So the plant pulls up a bunch of silica from the soil, deposits that silica, which is glass, right, in the outer portion of the plant. And on the outer portion of the plant, it's like really ribbed. And the plant is hollow. So when the plant dries, you rub this plant together, you get glass, little shards of glass that are all rubbing against each other with this hollow center, and it makes like a scream. The plant screams, and it sounds like a little girl. And so my grandma said her mom scared her once on the porch with this plant, rubbed a bunch of it together, and then my grandma thought there was a scream. And so I thought, oh, so a sinue is describing that scream sound. So a sinue, Gzebanushk, that's why it's called this. And so I was like, oh, so it has two meanings in one name. So I went to a plant expert in my community and I said, check out what I found out. And so he said the same thing. He said, I never thought that before, because he drinks the tea. And so he said, Gzebanushk, Gzebanushk is a sour taste. And so Gzebanushk or Gzebanushk, that's why it's called that, because the plant, when you go to taste it, it tastes sweet in your mouth. And then when you swallow it, it turns sour. So Gzebanushk, Gzebanushk, that's why we call it that. And so I was like, oh, there's three meanings in one name. And then so I was explaining to the a language group that I had like a whole presentation on it. It was super fun. And there was one woman in there listening to my presentation on this plant. And one of the things that I explained was that because this plant pulls up a bunch of silica from the soil and deposits it in the outside, silica is a hard abrasive crystal, like that's what we put on sandpaper. That's what we use to grind things down with. The reason why it's called scouring rush in English is because that's what everybody used for like a scouring pad before the industrialization of steel wool. Everyone used this plant. And so she heard that piece. And so she said, I have a question for you. And she said, how does your dad tell you to have a shower? And I was like, what? What kind of a question is it? And so I said, gzibigdiye is what he says. And she's like, what does that mean? So gzibi, I don't know, like soap. Dia is my butt. So clean my butt with soap. I don't know what this, what she's getting. And so she says, how does your dad tell you how to do dishes? Gzibigdognem. What does that mean? She said, oh, it's like, I don't know. It's like just cleaning. I don't know, understand. So she said, gzibi is when you're scrubbing something. So your dad, when he says gzibigdiye, he's telling you to scrub your butt. Or gzibignagnen, he's telling you to scrub all of those dishes. So gzibnashk, gzibi, that's what this plant is telling you, that there's a way that you can use it. And also like four meanings all in one name, right? Where it grows, a sound that it makes, how it tastes, a utility use that it has. And yeah, all of those are verbs. All of those are doings that this plant accomplishes. And when you see that plant and you say what its name is, you say, oh, look at this guy, Gzibnashk. You're not just saying a word, you're having an experience. Your mouth can pucker, your observation of the way that this plant has affected history, or but like by the via the tool that it was or always has been, and then, you know, sounds that it makes, and it turns into a whole experience. And all of that identity is projected just in the one name. That's why, like, yeah, I think it's really important for us to really learn what those names are, what they're describing. There's so much that can be captured as far as, you know, that plant's identity goes.
So one more thought before we go, because I know you can go here, Joe, we have a word in our language, pejuta, really meaning herb or medicine or plants that have medicine and special. But what we do is we tie it to the stars. You see, so every plant medicine has knowledge of the stars, because that's what they observe every day, the consciousness of the stars. And so they're incorporating, encoding that knowledge and intelligence of the stars inside the plants. Is there such a concept in your language with that?
So culturally and traditionally, these are understood, are getting better understood. But as far as specifically understood in language, I haven't even actually thought to think about that. How did you say that word in your language?
It's a pejuta. It's really meaning the stars' energy is here in the plants.
Oh, sweet. That's crazy. Yeah.
And just those thoughts like that. But that's something to talk with you maybe next time, because we just took a whole hour up of delivering what we need to, the bigger message, bigger than us. But I want to thank you, Joe Pitawanaka. Thanks for taking your time out and sharing your knowledge and you know, your experience. And because I think this is something, as you know, the world is needing right now, that knowledge is much greater, much bigger than we are as humans.
For sure. Yeah. Thanks for bringing me on. That's super fun. That hour just whizzed right past us. Nuts.
Yeah. Any last words or any thoughts for the listeners here?
Yeah, no, I'm super pumped. So we're really doing everything that we can to recapture and regather and have an understanding of the importance of what we would call mshkikiyadzuan, medicine knowledge. That's medicine knowledge for health, for language, for environmental health, for everything we do, everything that we can to share this knowledge in every way that we can. So lately, this has been virtually. So through our Facebook page is Creator's Garden. We're on YouTube. We have a content that's constantly being uploaded to. And then, like I said, I think one of my biggest, most exciting projects is having all of these names on our YouTube channel, just a place to go, a resource to go to learn about Anishinaabe taxonomy of the taxonomical process, every single plant that we have. I'm already a good ways into recording all of those sessions, so we'll be releasing those soon. I'm pumped.
Well, look forward to that. And thank you again, Joe Pitawanakat. And And that was Joe Pitawanakat of the Ojibwe Nation, is a plant medicine teacher reclaiming Anishinaabe names for species and reviving eons-old indigenous languages, which could help tackle climate crisis. A 2014 study estimates that roughly 30% of both the world's indigenous languages and animal species have declined between 1970 and 2009. Some conservationists and climate scientists believe the key to protecting endangered plants and animals is supporting efforts of maintaining indigenous languages. Language loss is especially acute in the Americas and Australia, where hundreds of indigenous languages are endangered. Linguists predict 50 to 90% of the world's 7,000 languages may not be spoken by the end of this century. And I'll spell Joe Pitawanakat's name for you, and where you can see his work on YouTube. It's Joe, Pitawanakat, Joe Pitawanakat. Ushimalaye oyate waniwachi chuelo. Thank you for joining us here on First Voices Radio. My name is Teokasin, Ghost Horse. Score Falls Around Her, that is Shade of History by Julian Cote, featuring Pura Fe Crescioni from Pine Needle Productions. And thank you for joining us for First Voices Radio. I'm Teokas and Ghost Horse. We'll see you, hear you next time.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Ataque aéreo estadounidense mata a 60.